It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, April 23rd. I'm Kobe Vance, in for Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, almost three dozen convicted felons in Mississippi could soon have their voting rights restored. Then, law enforcement officials in Jackson say a federal program meant to address gangs and other violent crimes in the capital city is set to begin soon. Plus, fluctuating crop prices have caused major shifts in what's being planted this year. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Thirty-two Mississippians convicted of felony offenses who have paid their debts to society could soon have their voting rights restored after lawmakers in the House and Senate advanced several suffrage bills out of committee. The move comes weeks after the Senate committee chairperson killed a House bill that would have automatically restored the voting rights for many more people convicted of nonviolent disenfranchising felonies. To have your voting rights restored in Mississippi, a disenfranchised person has to either receive a pardon from the governor or have a lawmaker introduce an individual suffrage bill that must be approved by a two-thirds majority in both chambers. Yesterday, House Judiciary B Committee advanced 27 suffrage bills. Committee Chairman Republican Representative Kevin Horan of Grenada spoke to reporters after the measures passed his committee.
I don't see any reason why at some point in time their right to vote should be restored, why it shouldn't be. Obviously, this process requires two or three filters. It'd be the Senate and the governor's office to look at each bill, like any other bill, determine whether or not they feel like they give the thumbs up or thumbs down, whether it be the Senate or the governor. So that's basically where we are. Other way around, once it the constitutional provision would have made it, then it would have been automatic, as opposed to us going through this every year, obviously.
But, yeah, I mean, I know y'all have to work within the parameters that you have.
Right.
But, I mean, do you think this is the best way to sort of go about restoring suffrage to someone? I mean, it requires someone convicted of a disenfranchising felony offense to know a legislator, ask them to introduce a bill on their behalf, and then
Someone be willing to do it as well. Be willing to do it, it has to go through this process.
I mean,
certainly don't think this is the best way to do it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have advanced the bill that we advanced. I mean, it's come a point in time where individuals that paid their debt to society, they're contributing to society, they're paying taxes, they're doing the things they need to do in society. There's no reason those individuals shouldn't have the right to vote. And also, I want to point out that one of the provisions that we move forward on this policy is make sure that there's no public funds being embezzled or stolen. There's no reason why right to vote should be treated any differently than other rights we give back to individuals. You know, give them a right to get a certain conviction expunged or a privilege to get certain convictions expunged. And some of these on this list, I think, are individuals that have had their convictions expunged and they're still not given the right to vote. So there's no reason to apply that double standard, in my opinion. There's a lot of other things under this dome that we need to be addressing that are a lot more important that is not being moved, and this is something that should be relatively simple for us to address.
That's Republican Representative Kevin Horan of Grenada. the Senate Judiciary B Committee advanced five suffrage bills on Monday. Republican Senator Joey Fillinghane of Sumrall chairs the committee. He tells our Will Stripling that this piecemeal approach to restoring voting rights is burdensome, but it's the only process they currently have.
Well, it's the constitutional process. I mean, we're strictly going by the state constitution. Now, there have been several bills filed over the last year or so to change that, but in most instances, they're statutory changes, which don't fix the constitutional problem. So you really have to change the constitution, not just change a statute, in order to fix that that problem. And I agree it's certainly not the easiest and probably least cumbersome way of doing it, but you know, we're bound to do what the Constitution requires of us until the Constitution is changed. So if someone wants to change the process, there's a constitutional amendment that's going to be required.
The House passed their bill this session and Senator Hill killed it. Do you think that there should have been substantive debate on this issue, that there should have at least been given the opportunity for the process to play out?
Well, definitely there's been a lot of conversation about it. I get calls and questions about it both from constituents as well as, of course, from the media. So it's certainly an issue that's being debated, and more so it's an issue that's being litigated. As you and your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, there's pending litigation at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And no one really knows, you know, until they come down with their decision how that's going to go one way or the other. I guess the position I'm in at Judd B. chair currently is that I have to abide by what the Constitution currently is. And you're correct. The one bill, I think, that did seek to change the Constitution went to the Constitution Committee, which I'm not in charge of. So at this point, we're taking bills up and we're passing them. I think the Senate and the House had about the same percentage of bills filed versus taken up and passed, because I believe the House had 45 bills. They passed 27 of them, I understand, today. We had 9 bills and passed 5 of them. So we did a little better than half, and sounds like maybe they did as well on their end, but certainly by no stretch did the House pass all 45 of their bills that were filed. And I say that in no disrespect. We didn't do that on our end either. So there's still discretion within legislatures as to which bills they do and don't want to take up. The Constitution doesn't say every bill that's filed must be passed. It says if you want to get your suffrage restored, this is the means whereby you can do that. So we're abiding by the Constitution. We're taking up bills. I intend to take them up on the floor. So, and certainly we will take up a look at the House bills once they get to us. I don't think we have them yet. They have to go through that engrossing process and get, you know, written up and sent over. But I suspect we'll see them in the next day or two.
Way more suffrage bills that have been taken up than in the last few years. So what do you make of that, just the large increase in this the process that exists being utilized this year, more so than it has in the past?
I'm very encouraged by it. I think that's the way the Constitution was set up. That's the way it's intended. Now, quite honestly, from year to year, sometimes I get a lot of phone calls. Other years, I may not even get a phone call. So it really just depends upon the people filing the bills and how engaged they are, you know, within the process. So I'm encouraged by it. It seems to me that people are more engaged, that we're hearing more talk and discussion, and maybe that's because of the litigation that's ongoing. You know, that could very well be part of the reason we're having an uptick in the conversation level. But I think it's positive. I think it's healthy for our democracy, and I'm excited and encouraged by that.
That's Republican Senator Joey Fillinghane of Sumrall. Under the Mississippi Constitution, people lose their right to vote for 22 felonies, including bribery, theft, timber larceny, carjacking, and arson. Mississippi's original list of disenfranchising crimes comes from the Jim Crow era, when authors of the state constitution removed voting rights for crimes they thought black people were more likely to commit. Democratic Senator Derek Simmons of Greenville tells our Will Stribling, voting rights should automatically be restored after felons pay their debt to society.
I would like to see a right of suffrage being automatically restored after a person has done his or her time. So I would like to see legislation that we could pass in this body that will automatically restore people's rights to vote. As you know, Will, it's a sacred and fundamental right that was taken away. And once a person has paid his or her debt to society and has been rehabilitated and is now a law-abiding citizen, I think all their rights should be restored.
What are your thoughts on the bill that the House passed this session, and then your thoughts on Senator Hill killing that bill and not even allowing any debate to take place?
I fully supported the House bill, and I'm on the Constitution Committee, and it is certainly Chairman Hill's prerogative to bring bills up or not. And so I respect that, the power of a chairman, because as you know, I'm a chairman myself. But I would like to get more consideration next year on a bill that, again, will automatically restore a person's right to vote.
A consideration that came up was, you know, whether or not the victims of any crime had been made whole, if restitution had been paid. Do you think that needs to be a factor or shouldn't be a factor in this process if there is a move towards an automatic restoration?
In fact, inherently in the discharge that a person receives from the Mississippi Department of Corrections, all fines, restitution, and assessments have to be paid in order for that person to get discharged. So I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that being raised or being a condition of a person's right to suffrage, because you can't get discharged from MDOC unless that has been done.
And there's been discussion around nonviolent felons. Do you think that limitation is appropriate, that someone who might have committed an armed robbery or shouldn't have their voting rights restored, even if it's been decades, they've been released and have been an exemplary citizen since then?
I think we should look at it on a case-by-case basis or come up with some criteria that should be acceptable to both chambers. But I'm not opposed to allowing a person who has a violent offense, who have paid his or her debt to society, to have their right of suffrage or their right to vote restored.
That's Democratic Senator Derek Simmons of Greenville talking with R. Will Stribling. Coming up, law enforcement officials in Jackson say a federal program meant to address gangs and other violent crimes in the capital city is set to begin soon. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
MPB is bringing on the experts for our Tuesday local shows. Money Talks helps you with your personal finance at 9 a.m. In Legal Terms at 10 is about you and your rights. Southern Remedy, Relatively Speaking, helps you navigate personal relationships at 11. Coming up next after Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio or find their podcasts.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. You know, that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 3 on Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kobe Vance. The city of Jackson has a gang problem, according to its police chief. But a new initiative funded by the Department of Justice is about to begin in the capital city to help decrease the rate of crime and violence. Jackson was one of three cities across the country recently selected to be part of a nearly $80 million investment to support community violence intervention. While Jackson's murder rate dropped nearly 15% last year, it still remains among the highest in the nation. Jackson Police Chief Joseph Wade tells our Mike McEwen the city has to be intentional about gang violence, and he's been meeting with federal partners to determine the most strategic approach.
We're starting right now from scratch, but the U.S. Attorney Todd G. has made a commitment to the city of Jackson to assist us with our gang initiative. He's bringing in resources from Washington, D.C. to help us with it. We realize that gang activity, drug activity, and this cycle of retaliation has contributed to a lot of our violent crimes here in the city of Jackson. So we've identified it. We've identified gang members. We've identified gangs, specifically which ones they belong to and their affiliation. And they're going to help us work through the dynamics of what that looks like. So it'll be an intentional approach as we identify these people who embark upon gang activity and this constant violence here in our city.
Department of Public Safety data, more or less over the past 10 years, shows that violent crime and gun crime in the state, especially in Jackson, has more or less remained the same. Why is now the time to bring in this federal gang task force and the violent crime initiative to try and address this?
Us believing that it doesn't exist simply because we don't want to acknowledge that there is a problem does not make that problem go away. I am acknowledging that we have a gang problem. As the chief of police, I make that acknowledgement because I talk to families whose children or their, you know, sons were gang affiliated. And they're telling me what gangs has something to do with their child being killed or, you know, him or her losing their life. I'm also looking at what we're doing now as part of our new intentional and strategic approach. As we come in contact with individuals here in the city of Jackson, we're doing field contact forms. You may not be, you know, arrested for anything, may not have an arrestable offense, but we're going to ask that simple question, are you gang affiliated? And believe it or not, they answered that question with a badge of honor. Yes, I belong to so-and-so, so-and-so. We're collecting that information. We're collecting that data. And we're going to take a holistic approach to deal with gang activity here in the city of Jackson. I've been on since the 90s. Back then, it was more defined. You had vice lords here. You had black gangster disciples over there. But now, some of them are actually partnering together. But they still maintain their affiliation with what particular gang that they belong to. So we're looking at these very interesting dynamics as they exist currently. And we have a lot of neighborhood factions. We have a lot of factions that claim a certain part of town. We want to look at those dynamics, identify who the players are, and take a holistic approach to it. Me lock you up for over the weekend is not going to address this issue. But it's dealing with it holistically and seeing what crimes are generated or what byproducts of your gang activity, you know, what it is it gun violence? Is it drug activity? Put all the pieces together, and then that's where I think the federal partnership with DOJ is going to play a very important, crucial part to ridding the city of this very, very violent gang activity.
Last question. You said you're kind of just now putting the building blocks down and implementing things. Is there a general idea or timeline or window of time in which you think this federal presence might be here?
Well, we've actually had some meetings with some of the individuals that have been brought in already. So I would say probably by midsummer, we should be on the ground running, boots on the ground. But I'm not looking at a, you know, run around, lock them up, you know, jump out van approach. I'm looking at a holistic approach. I'm looking at the prosecution side, you know, as we move forward, because we want to make sure that we get rid of the problem, we get to the root of the problem, and we find out who are the shot callers here in the city of Jackson. And we know that they exist because we see the people that are going out here committing criminal acts. We want to deep dive with our federal resources to find out who they are so we can make a permanent impact on gang violence in the city of Jackson.
That's Jackson Police Chief Joseph Wade. Coming up, fluctuating crop prices have caused major shifts in what's being planted this year. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
The 10-Minute Timeout is a mini-podcast that brings Mississippi sports stories to life. Join me, Lacey Alexander, as I learn more about the teams, athletes, staff, and programs that make our state proud. One-on-one interviews with influential playmakers paint a clear picture for listeners of how Mississippi sports inspire and energize our community. New episodes released every other Friday on your favorite podcasting app.
I'm Celeste Headley. Airplanes are one of the fastest growing sources of climate warming pollution on the planet, but scientists are creating new fuels to clean up aviation, even battery-powered crop dusters.
It's 9 feet above the crop canopy, going about 70 miles an hour. So, like, nothing can go wrong.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at noon on MPB Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kobe Vance. Crop prices in Mississippi have seen major changes this year over last. Corn has dropped by roughly $2 a bushel, and other crops like cotton and soybeans are on the rise. That's according to a recent report from the Mississippi State Extension Service. To account for this change in price, farmers are adjusting their planting this year to meet demand and hopefully turn a decent profit. We speak with Will Maples, an agricultural economist with the Extension Service, about what these changes could mean for both farmers and consumers in the coming year.
It's not surprising because the last couple of years we have had record high crop prices across the board, not just for corn, soybeans, cotton, have all been up. And so the deal with corn really is last year we had really good prices and we planted a lot of corn across the whole country. So it's not just Mississippi prices, it's across the country prices are down. And so what that means is we have a lot of supply weighing down on the market right now just due to the crop from last year. So coming into this year, we're bringing in a lot of leftover bushels from last year that's just weighing down on the market.
Meanwhile, y'all are also seeing some pretty big growth in some areas, it seems, with cotton and soybeans being planted at higher volumes this year, in terms, I should say higher acreage this year. Was that common to see these kind of fluctuations?
Yes, I would say so. So in Mississippi specifically, you know, soybeans is our most planted crop every year. So, I mean, it's by far and away over 2 million acres a year. It's our biggest crop. We always expect to see that. Over the last few years, cotton and corn have just kind of swapped places as we've each year, kind of as prices dictate. So like this year with lower corn prices and cotton's a little bit better, it wasn't surprising to see cotton come out ahead. So like last year, we planted a lot more corn than we did cotton just because corn prices were better compared to cotton.
What does this all mean for farmers?
So for farmers, really, they just need to understand that what the prices are right now doesn't mean that's where the prices are staying. We're looking at prices for a crop that's not even been planted yet. So it's important for farmers to kind of understand that there will be opportunities going forward potentially for higher prices. And so my main thing to tell producers this time of year is they need to have a marketing plan in place and understand if once planting starts and say just hypothetically for some reason corn planting slow down, have weather interruptions and get slowed down and just don't go as efficiently as they should, that can lead to a price rally. And farmers need to be keeping an eye on the market and knowing when and taking advantage of any prices rallies that we see.
What do farmers look for in the markets to be able to identify what crops are worth planting that year?
The main thing they're looking at is their actual cost of production. So they need to understand, have a price in mind of what do I need to sell a bushel of corn or soybeans for in order to break even. So we call it their break-even price. And so based off that break-even price is where they need to start then determining, all right, looking at the market, this current price of corn, I can sell corn today for 20 cents over my break-even, for example. I might need to consider that going forward. But the most important thing is farmers don't just look at the price in the market. They need to understand how that price relates back to their actual cost of production.
With the changes in how people are shifting away from corn and moving into, let's say, soybeans or cotton, is it common to see big shifts, as in like 25% more or less of a product within year to year?
It is in Mississippi. We see between especially that corn to cotton mix each year, we see those shifts pretty regularly in past years. Nationwide, it wasn't that big of a shift. Corn acres is down nationwide, and soybeans is up a little bit. But, and that's really nationwide corn plantings is what drives the market more so than Mississippi, because we're a very small number of acres of corn are grown in Mississippi out of the whole nation. But for Mississippi, it's not shocking to see the numbers that we did this year.
Gotcha. And then how do you see Mississippi, I guess, not completely moving away, but reducing corn production? Do you think that's going to have any effect on the production of, since it is one of the most versatile crops out there, things like oils, feed, anything like that?
Most of Mississippi corn, and I don't have hard numbers on this, but it's pretty much going to feed the poultry industry, more than likely. And kind of as I mentioned before, I mean, Mississippi, we're such a 700,000 acres of corn out of 90 million acres of corn is not a lot. So overall, I doubt you see much disruptions of any type of production of other products due to us reducing acres.
Will Maples with the Mississippi State Extension Service, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.